United Nations says it needs $5 billion in aid to stop Afghanistan from sinking into a humanitarian crisis this year. China puts millions of people in the city of Xi'an under lockdown for a third week after a flare-up of COVID infections. Palestinians stage a rally in the occupied West Bank to protest the Tel Aviv regime's raid on the Beer Sheva University campus and the arrest of several students. Welcome. Top story this hour, the United Nations saying it needs $5 billion in aid to stop Afghanistan from sinking into a humanitarian crisis, and that's the organization's biggest ever appeal for a single country.
This is a stopgap, an absolutely essential stopgap measure that we are putting in front of the international community today. Without this being funded, there won't be a future. We need this to be done, otherwise there will be outflow, there will be suffering.
Griffiths warning that the absence of humanitarian aid could lead to more deaths, hunger, and further mass displacement. He says that the funding would help the Afghan economy and facilitate humanitarian agencies' operations. A lack of funding is battering Afghanistan's already troubled economy. The country is on the edge of a full-blown crisis, with Washington freezing billions of dollars of its assets since the Taliban's takeover in mid-August. Aid supplies have been disrupted, leading to rising poverty and hunger. We've reached out to political analyst Munir Ahmed for his take on economic and humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. He says that the U.S. and international organizations take no action when it comes to solving problems in that country.
Unfortunately, we are talking a lot about the crisis, but we are only talking and chatting about these things. And even now, they have appealed $5 billion, and this is a major step that we shall welcome. But how long we shall keep on inviting people to talk about it or like discussing it? Because it is totally disgusting that we are not taking any practical step. The other humanitarian organizations and the international organizations need to immediately act upon with some practical steps. But we don't see major aid going to Afghanistan. And on the other hand, though United States have agreed to unfreeze financial assets of Afghanistan, but still we don't see any promise coming to reality, and it is still there is no practical step taken to unfreeze the financial assets of Afghanistan. And this is really a major what I shall say, the just a bunch of words that we are listening from different corners of the world.
The coronavirus is spreading fast across Asian continent, with some countries, including China and Japan, extending measures to contain the virus. China has 110 new cases. The country is battling with a virus with a mix of lockdowns and restrictions. Three major cities in Henan province have introduced new restrictions, while millions of people in Xi'an city remain in lockdown for a third week. Hong Kong also ramped up its curbs, shuttering kindergartens and elementary schools until February. Japan is also battling an Omicron-fueled surge in infections. Authorities there have implemented a strict border policy that bars almost all new foreign arrivals until the end of next month. The Japanese government will also reopen mass vaccination centers to accelerate booster shots. Time now for the news review section. Two new highs in a single day for the U.S. The nation is dealing with an explosion in daily COVID infections and hospitalizations as an Omicron wave is sweeping the country. Could this mean that a pandemic has defeated America?
The pandemic appears to be spiraling out of control in the United States, pushing the country into uncharted territory. Many states are witnessing a dramatic surge in infections. Just in a single day, two new records have been set, sounding the alarm about the severity of the situation. Authorities are now reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The previous record set last week was just a little above 1 million. The 7-day average has also been soaring in recent weeks. It's now over 700,000 cases a day, 3 times higher than 2 weeks ago. Deaths have also increased, averaging around 1,700 per day. That's 20% up from 1,400 posted in recent days. Omicron is largely to blame for the rise. The extremely contagious variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, and the US is no exception. It's the world's worst-hit nation by far, with around 62 million cases and over 800,000 deaths. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. US medical centers are already overwhelmed, and the Omicron wave is now pushing them to the brink. The number of daily hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 more patients are being treated in hospitals whose staff have already been worn out by the Delta variant.
I've never seen anything like it since I've been a nurse. I was an LPN prior to becoming an RN. And I can tell you that there has been more deaths that I've seen the whole time in just 1 week that I normally see in a month, let alone in a day.
Experts are of the opinion that many Americans' refusal to get their shots is probably one key factor stoking the spike. About 37% of the population has not been fully vaccinated. Some cities like Chicago and New York are imposing restrictions and vaccination rules to curb the trend, the kind of measures that are likely to once more bring anti-vaxxers onto the streets. Whatever the causes may be, the facts speak for themselves. The battle against the coronavirus is a tough one, and the U.S., already the number one in many global categories, has now one more to add to its records, the world's number one in its failure against the virus.
Allow me to invite two guests to see what the situation is like in their opinion and what the reasons are. So Ian Williams, a senior analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus, joining me out of New York, and Frank Imspach, emeritus professor with the University of Wisconsin out of Madison. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Turning to the Big Apple, Ian, tell us about the factors leading to this situation. You just heard the big numbers. You know, lots of people are losing their lives to COVID.
Well, huge numbers, and New York is the sort of epicenter for all of the reasons. It's filled with a lot of people who are poor demographics from minorities who didn't have the luxury of taking to the mountains or the beaches or to their villas during the epidemic. They have to stay here and work. They have to use public transport. And so it's an infectious hotbed. But actually, people in New York do tend to wear masks. There's much less anti-vaccine sentiment than in the hinterland. There's a lot of take-up, but the even though New York is better equipped than most places, this country is not equipped to deal with massive public health enterprises as a general rule. You know, the health service is private, it's scattered, it's a mixture of contracts I applied a week or so ago for an at-home COVID test. I've got other things that I need to take. I don't think that if I suspect I have COVID, I should get on public transport, spray my virus up and down Manhattan on the way to a testing center, spray it around the center, and then come back again. I think it's much better for me to hunker down. So just before you called, I had a call from the clinic fixing the appointment I asked for a week ago for the 18th in 2 weeks. This is hardly lightning responses to people, in the face of an epidemic. If this was bubonic plague, I'd be dead by the time they turned up to test. It's this lack of coordinated response, and the country doesn't really have the capability of a coordinated response. Mm-hmm. They don't have a public health infrastructure that will do it. And on top of that, you have the whole anti-science barbarism, where the huge numbers of the armed forces are refusing to take the vaccine on ideological grounds. They've been told that it's somehow anti-Republican and anti-Trump and socialist to take a vaccine and to be vaccinated. It didn't stop them with smallpox, because I believe to join the army and go on tropical duty, you need a smallpox vaccination. If you want to send your children to a public school in New York, you have to present a whole battery of vaccination tests. But somehow this particular one, this creed of anti-science, has been tied in with the politics. And you know, when history comes to be written, people like Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis will have hundreds of thousands of deaths on their epitaph, because they fermented and frustrated. You know, in Florida, the governor of Florida is actually stopping localities enforcing rules that might mitigate the epidemic. He's saying they can't have mask mandates. He said they can't have vaccine mandates. New York, on the other hand, is a pioneer. I mean, it was here a century and a half ago. There was a woman a cook who had typhoid, asymptomatic typhoid, which she spread on to all of the people she cooked for. And in the end, they had to invent a law to lock her up to stop her, because she kept going back to the only job she knew, which was cooking and spreading typhoid.
Right.
And people said, well, you know, sorry, yes, you have your rights, but no, you don't have the right to infect other people and kill them. And that's the key point. Yes, they have the right not to take the vaccine. But then other people have the right to say, if you don't take the vaccine, you can't work in a hospital, you can't work in a care home, you can't work in a shop, you can't go on public transport. But then, you know, once again, we get the politics. Some of the worst offenders in the New York subway system are the Manhattan police. The New York police consistently stand there without vaccines and have beaten people up who called them out on it because of their sense of impunity and, you know, their loyalties to Trump and his like. So, you know, the rules are haphazardly a form. But, you know, this country, yes, it's been brought to its knees by the COVID epidemic. And I'm really surprised I think they will be. I think there's a bill to be paid, and in the next year or two, those bills will come due.
Okay, looks like we lost the line, but Ian almost made his point. Now, Professor Anspach, you let our viewers know what you believe are these factors contributing to this horrible situation in terms of COVID in the United States, the largest economy in the world. Why is it happening?
Well, I think it's happening for the reasons that the prior speaker said. You don't really have a health system here. You have a lot of small businesses who've been taken over by large businesses, but you don't have a system. We used to talk about, the United States used to talk about it, rationing in healthcare. The fact of the matter is, and this shows it, that if everybody had to show up to get healthcare, the system can't do it. It's simply not set up for that. It's a set up to make money. And that's the first thing. The second thing is lack of capacity in terms of the actual manufacturing and distribution of those things. You know, it simply doesn't exist. So when President Biden says, I'm going to, you know, mandate or try to get 500,000 vaccines or 500,000 test kits, it's a problem. It can't just be done, and it needs to be done. So you have a lack of abilities on the one hand, and a serious political movement on the other. And that is really crippling it. You cannot have what they call herd immunity, or, you know, getting rid of the masks and things like that, until you're up around over 90% vaccination. And it does not appear that that's going to be achievable here, which means that you are always going, for a long time, going to be in the thrall of these perpetual waves of virus, you know, uncomfortable masks and so on.
Right.
Because you have to get to a certain point before those can go away. And the consequences, I think, politically, are very, very serious, because clearly the Republicans are going to run on the basis that Biden's an incompetent, couldn't deal with the virus, you know, is driving the country to death and destruction. Oh, that's a pretty serious thing, particularly when you're starting out with a third or 25 or 30% of the people already believe it. In other words, it's an achievable political goal to destroy the president over the basis of the response on the virus, even though he is not responsible for it and doing what he can to deal with it.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Ian Williams, senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, joining me from New York, and Frank Anspach, emeritus professor with the University of Wisconsin out of Madison. Now, moving on, Palestinians stage a rally in the occupied West Bank to protest the Tel Aviv regime's raid on the Berzeit University campus and the arrest of several students. Israeli forces fired rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse the ralliers who gathered at the northern entrance of the city of Ramallah. Dozens were injured, with one protester being directly hit by a rubber bullet in the head. On Monday, a group of Israeli troops stormed Berzeit University and fired live ammunition on the campus. Regime forces injured and detained a number of students during the raid. Russia says its first round of talks with the U.S. over the Ukraine crisis have provided no ground for optimism.
We see no real reason to be optimistic so far. The first round of the talks was positive and held in an open, substantive, and direct manner. But the purpose of this negotiation process is not the process itself, so it cannot satisfy us. The talks' result is significant, but nothing can be said about the result yet.
Now, Peskov says the situation will be clear after more rounds of talks. Russian-American diplomats sat down for secure negotiations in Geneva on Monday. Moscow is set to hold further talks with NATO and Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe later this week. Peskov says that his country is not setting any deadlines for meetings, but doesn't want the process to drag on forever. Moscow has demanded that the U.S.-led NATO rule out admitting Ukraine as a member and stop the alliance's eastward expansion. The U.S. rejects those demands. It says progress in the talks depends on de-escalation from Moscow. The U.S. and NATO accuse Russia of planning to invade Ukraine. Russia denies that and says its military buildup on the border is only defensive.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey said the UK needs ambitious climate policies, but they will always be better if we work together with international partners. The Conservatives' failure to do this is now hitting British business at the worst possible time, as energy-intensive firms are struggling with sky-high gas prices. I prepared for you an article written by environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Brexit Decision Left UK Firms Paying 10% More Than EU Rivals for Emissions. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. British businesses are paying substantially more to produce carbon dioxide than their EU rivals because of the government's refusal to link the UK carbon market to the bigger European markets after Brexit. The difference is putting UK industry at a significant competitive disadvantage to European rivals at a time of soaring energy prices, but does not result in any additional benefit to the environment. British companies are paying more than £75, that is €90 a ton, for the carbon they emit, while similar industries in the European Union are paying up to about €85 a ton. The difference has narrowed slightly in recent days, but was reaching about 8 to 9 euros a ton of carbon in the past month, equating to a premium of about 10% being paid by British companies. Britain's carbon price is higher because the UK carbon market, set up last year with the first permit auctions taking place last May, is much smaller and lacks the liquidity of the larger European Union Emissions Trading Scheme, or EU ETS, that has been operating since 2005 and covers all of the European Union's heavy industries. Under both schemes, companies buy tradable permits to cover the carbon dioxide they produce, with cleaner companies able to sell spares to laggards. The price acts as an incentive to companies to clean up their operations and is seen as an economically efficient way to help meet the net zero emissions target. Ministers have a short window in which to reduce UK carbon prices before 18th of January, the deadline for the government to release extra permits onto the market, which could reduce some of the price pressure. But experts said linking to the European Union market would provide a better longer-term answer and make economic and environmental sense. Tom Lord, the head of the trading at Redshaw Advisors, said British companies are paying substantially more than they are in the European Union. The big problem for the UK market is liquidity and the fact that it is new. The European Union has a historic surplus of permits to fall back on, but the UK has pent-up demand and only a drip feed of supply. Lawson Steele, joint head of carbon and utilities research at Berenberg Bank, said, "This is a disadvantage to UK companies. The reality is that the United Kingdom carbon market is dwarfed by the European Union's ETS. Given that the UK wants to trade with the European Union and the European Union wants to trade with the United Kingdom, it would make sense for companies to be on the same carbon footing." British companies already pay higher prices for energy than their EU counterparts, amounting to about £35 a megawatt hour more, added Joe Morris of UK Steel, which represents the steel industry. Joe Morris added, "This is a long-running bugbear for the steel sector and something that continues to hamper our international competitiveness." He said the effect of both higher carbon prices and higher energy prices than the European Union, as well as the lack of a post-Brexit deal with the United States, which recently dropped its tariffs on EU steel, was to deter investment, adding, "This affects the competitiveness of steel companies, which links to investment in these companies. It affects our members' confidence and does not help people who work in the sector." Joe Morris added, "Steel companies were firmly behind the net zero strategy, seeing the push for decarbonisation as offering a competitive advantage." He said, "There's an opportunity to be world-leading in green steel and net-zero steel." Berenberg Steel added, "Politicians tempted by high energy prices to dismantle net-zero policies were mistaken." He said, "Blaming the carbon price is baloney. Increasing energy prices in the last year have been 85% due to the gas price. Carbon is not the problem." British government has so far not explained why it has rejected a link with the European Union system, but many suspect it is part of the desire for a clean break, hard Brexit, maintaining as few regulatory links as possible. The Liberal Democrats and the Green Party called on the government to link the UK ETS to the EU system. If the European Union agreed, linking could probably be achieved fairly easily, as the UK system is modelled on the EU market, which the UK was a core part of and took a leading role in designing and updating whilst an EU member. The Liberal Democrat leader, Ed Davies, said, "The United Kingdom needs ambitious climate policies, but they will always be better if we work together with international partners. The Conservatives' failure to do this is now hitting British business at the worst possible time, as energy-intensive firms are struggling with sky-high gas prices." Molly Scott-Cato, the Green Party from the Green Party, said, "It's clearly irrational, inefficient, and the result of destructive Brexit ideology to try to run an independent UK carbon trading system with all of its additional costs, inevitable inconsistencies, and opportunities for gaming the market." For years after the 2008 financial crisis, the European Union's carbon market suffered a glut of permits and was largely ineffective as the carbon price crashed. However, in recent years, reforms and the renewed need to slash emissions have pushed up prices, and it is now working as intended, spurring investment in low-carbon technologies. Ministers have no plans to seek a link with the European Union ETS, but are understood not to have ruled out the possibility entirely. A spokesperson for the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "The UK ETS authority is considering whether to take any appropriate action under the cost containment mechanism to release more permits on the market, and will announce this decision no later than 18th of January to provide certainty to the market." Moreover, UK manufacturers have warned that Brexit will add to soaring costs facing British industry amid concerns that customs delays and red tape will rank among the biggest challenges for firms this year. Make UK, the industry body representing 20,000 manufacturing firms of all sizes from across the country, said that while optimism amongst its members had grown, it was being undermined by the after-effects of the UK's departure from the European Union. 1 year on from the end of the transition period, two-thirds of industrial company leaders in its survey of 228 firms said Brexit had moderately or significantly hampered their business. More than half of firms warned they were likely to suffer further damage this year from customs delays due to import checks and changes to product labelling. According to the 2022 Make UK PwC Senior Executive Survey, Brexit disruption remains among the biggest concerns facing industry bosses for the year ahead, as Britain's departure from the European Union complicates the fallout from COVID-19 and the rising costs facing companies. Delays at customs, the additional costs from meeting separate regulatory regimes in the UK and the European Union, and reduced access to migrant workers were among top concerns raised in the survey. The report said, "It is clear from these figures that Brexit and the global COVID-19 pandemic have had a scarring effect on the mentality of many businesses, which are traumatized by the ongoing delays and disruptions to their supply chains."
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his perfect progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Canon Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. As you have been following and listening such shows from IRIB English Radio, in this series of shows, we are trying to talk about the questions and, let's say, the doubts and misconceptions that we are receiving from different questioners all around the world. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher and scholar Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools to this show to help us to answer the questions. Before asking the first question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day that we want to ask it here and actually discuss it with the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, is about the event of Ghadir. Ghadir is the day that Imam Ali alayhi salam has been appointed by the Holy Prophet in Hajjat al-Wada, and the way back to Medina, in an area or in an area called Ghadir, as the first successor of the Holy Prophet and the Imam of the Islamic Ummah right after the Holy Prophet. So the question is that why Imam Ali alayhi salam and Lady Fatima salamullah alayha, in their own life at the time of caliphate of the first and second caliphs, never referred to the event of Ghadir? And also, before that, why they never even talked about this right after the demise of the Holy Prophet, at the time that people were busy in Saqifah Bani Sa'ada to make decision for the successor of the Holy Prophet? This is the core of the question today. I want Sheikh Nur Muhammad to shed some light on that, and actually to answer this question from two phases. One, why didn't they, Imam Ali al-Salam and Lady Fatima salamullah alayha, react to whatever had happened right after the demise of the Holy Prophet at the time of Saqifa, when some companions of the Holy Prophet went to a place entitled or called as Saqifa Bani Sa'ad and made a decision for the successor of the Holy Prophet and the Caliph after the Prophet? What was the reason that they were silent?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, you know that Imam Ali alayhi salatu was salam, for numerous times and occasion, on different occasions, starting from the beginning of the caliphate of Abu Bakr, he started, arguing against the caliph system.
Yeah.
And of course, it has been quoted and narrated by the Sunni scholars. They have been mentioned. If you let me introduce you one source for that. You can refer to Al-Qadir and Allama Amini in that book. He introduced more than 100 pages about the argument and al-ihtijajat wal-munashadat of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa salam, which means the arguments of Imam Ali against the caliphate from the Sunni narrators.
Yeah.
And Imam Ali mentioned that, of course, on numerous times and occasions. Of course, in the beginning of the caliphate system and in the Saqifa, it was a very complicated time and occasion. And, of course, in that time, while Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam and the companions of the noble prophet, most of the companions, of course, they joined the army of Osama. And of course, some of the, Ahlul Bayt and the particular companion, they were engaging in the, doing ghusl and the ablution for the noble prophets. And of course, the process of the burial possession for the noble prophet.
Yeah.
In that, difficult time, suddenly the Saqifa happened.
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, from the second caliph, Umar, he mentioned that the kana bi'atu Abi Bakr falta wa ghafla. وَقَلَّهُ شَرَّهَا. It has been mentioned in Sunni sources that the second caliph Umar, he mentioned that the caliphate of Abu Bakr was suddenly, yes. And may Allah save us against that, the problem and the evil of that. Mm-hmm. You see that in that harsh time and the difficult time, suddenly they chose one person, an individual, as a successor of the noble Prophet Muhammad. And of course, by the terror and by the, you know, terrorizing people and frightening people, they mm-hmm. could conquer the minds of the people. And in a very harsh manner, they could confiscate the rights of the Imam, the rights of the caliphate of Imam Ali. And of course, all companions, they knew that the right of the successorship is only for Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and he is the immediate successor of the noble prophet. And of course, all of them, they remembered and reminded the time of the Qadir, what happened, and noble prophet introduced him to be a immediate successor of the noble prophet. But I said that it has some political, you know, agenda behind that action.
So, Sheikh, why didn't any of the companions actually complain and even show a sort of reaction towards what happening in the Saqifa? I mean, they were all silent.
Of course, as I said, in that time, most of the companions, they joined the army of Osama, okay? Mm-hmm. And I said by terrorizing people and frightening people, they could, you know, do and they could overcome the circumstances and become that individual, and the first caliph became the successor of the noble prophet. You see that, of course, we have the first arguments of Imam Ali started when they wanted to bring Imam Ali and to receive the bay'ah, okay? Mm-hmm. And they received the pledge from Imam Ali alayhi salam for the first caliph Abu Bakr. In that time, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam mentioned that, Ya ma'ashar al-Muslimin wal-Muhajirin wal-Ansar, unshidukum Allah, asama'atum Rasulallah, yaqul yawma qadirikum. And it continues. Imam mentioned that he reminded them that, swear to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, wouldn't you remind that noble prophet assigned me as his own immediate successor in the beginning when they wanted to bring Imam Ali and to carry him to the doing a pledge with the first caliph. And of course, after that, mm-hmm. in the time of the first caliph and the second caliph, it has been mentioned.
Yeah, this is the second phase of our, let's say, discussion that I wanted you to explain about. So during the time of caliphate of the first and second caliphs, were there any objections from the side of Imam Ali alayhi salam? Because about that time, Lady Fatima passed away. I mean, because she stayed for almost 90 into 95 days after the Holy Prophet. It means that she was martyred very soon. So the reaction of Imam Ali alayhi salam, any statement, any, let's say, clear-cut objection of Imam Ali alayhi salam has been recorded in the history or not?
Of course, we have numerous. As I said, I think Nahjul Balagha is enough and is available for everybody. They can go and refer to Nahjul Balagha, mm-hmm. or, for example, the speech of Sheikh Shaqiyya and many other narrations of Imam Ali and the speeches of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam,
yeah.
against the caliphate system. لَقَدْ تَقَمَّسَهَا Abi Quhaf, Ibn Abi Quhafa, mm-hmm. and of course many other speeches of Imam Ali against the caliphate system. He said that the Ibn Abi Quhafa, referring to Abu Bakr, he was unqualified and he became the caliph after the noble prophet, while he does not have the quality mm-hmm. to being the, you know, successor of the noble prophet. Many speeches of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, even in Nahjul Balagha, he mentioned against the caliphate system very, you know, publicly. He mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it has been recorded in history.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back. can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
You are talking about the qualification of the person for being appointed as caliph, but there were some other, let's say, factors that was making sense for the people at that time. One of them was the elderly, being elderly and aged, because he was old, and they said that since he was old, he is more qualified in comparison to others. And Imam Ali alayhi salam was young at that time, and he was almost 33 years, if I'm not mistaken. So was it a good factor to be included as a caliph, rather that there was a clear nas, clear order from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Prophet?
Of course not, because I mentioned the army of Osama. Osama was a very young person, okay, and noble Prophet assigned him to be ahead of the army, okay, and of course in that time some of the companions, they complain and they argue against the noble Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Why you specify that individual and young man to be ahead of army? Of course, we had these arguments for against the noble Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, but it is not acceptable. How elderly to be elder, it does not mean that you are qualified one.
Yeah.
And of course, we have وَآتَيْنَاهُ الْحُكْمَ السَّبِيَّةِ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, I think it's referring to one of the prophets that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, while he was a sabi, which means that he was a child, we give him this wisdom, and he became the prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, we have about some of the prophets, teenagers, while they were child. And of course, even some of the a'imma of Ahlul Bayt, like Imam Jawad alayhi salatu wasalam, while they were child, they become imams, and they become the prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa salam, he was, in that time, he was a strong man in that time, and he was about 30 years old in that time, about that time. And everybody, he was well known among people to be wise man, and of course to have the attributes, to have the successor of the noble prophet.
Very true. And we know that we have a case of a prophet while he was in the cradle. He's a prophet. So when Allah's actually order can come to make a person, to appoint a person as a prophet while he is still in cradle, so why not to appoint a person while he is in his 30s?
You see, my brother, the assignment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be a prophet, that assigning the individual to be a successor of the prophet or a imam, it is only in the hand of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Very true.
Nobody can decide, even the ummah, even the, community of the Muslim, they cannot a specific one individual and assign him to be a successor of the noble prophet. It is only by the assignment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because he knows the best, who is a most qualified to be a successor for the prophet. It is not actually in the hand of the people or Muslim or, for example, anybody else to assign for people to be a successor of the prophet.
Many thanks, dear Sheikh, for your answers to the questions, and you, respected listeners, for staying tuned and listening to IRIB English Radio. I leave in Allah's protection till our next show. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن. لعلي وحسين وحسن.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A report released recently, nearly 20 years after the first prisoners arrived at the naval station Guantanamo Bay, details systematic abuses carried out by the United States Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and U.S. military since 2001. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading 20 Years of U.S. Torture and Counting. Report details post 9/11 abuse at Gitmo and beyond. Stay tuned for more. Released recently, nearly 20 years after the first prisoners arrived at the naval station Guantanamo Bay, details systematic abuses carried out by the United States Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and U.S. military since the 2001 terrorist attacks. Entitled Legacy of the Dark Side, the cost of unlawful U.S. detentions and interrogations post 9/11, the new paper was published by Human Rights Watch, HRW, and the cost of war project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. This report lays out a comprehensive assessment of the many unconscionable costs of U.S. torture and illegal detentions and renditions over the past 20 years since 9/11, said Stephanie Saval, co-director of the Cost of War Project, in a statement, adding, "This is a moral failure of epic proportions, a stain on the U.S. human rights record, and a strategic blunder, and an abhorrent perpetuation of Islamophobia and racism." The authors assess the massive cost of U.S. extraordinary renditions, unlawful detentions, and torture after September 11, including to the victims and suspects, to U.S. taxpayers and to U.S. moral authority and counterterrorism efforts worldwide, ultimately jeopardizing universal human rights protections for anyone. They argue that significant counterterrorism reforms, including closing the prison at Guantanamo, strengthening measures to protect civilians from death and harm, increasing transparency and accountability for the crimes the United States has committed, and addressing religious and racial biases are critical steps toward mitigating the damage. The assessment comes ahead of the report, which will mark two decades since the first 20 men to be imprisoned at the Guantanamo Bay prison were flown to the base aboard a U.S. military plane. There are now 39 men detained there. 27 of them have not been charged with a crime. Many lack adequate medical care and even access to their medical records, making the prison a living legacy of the rights violations spawned by 9/11, the report explains. The military commission system created to prosecute suspects at Guantanamo is fundamentally flawed. As a result, the five prisoners accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks have yet to be brought to trial, depriving them of due process, and the survivors and the families of the nearly 3,000 people who died in the attacks of their right to justice, the report added. Common Dreams reported last month the Pentagon is supposedly building a new $4 million courtroom to be assembled at Guantanamo by next year that will enable prosecutors to hold two simultaneous trials. At least 780 men and boys have been held at the prison since it opened in 2002, after then-President George W. Bush declared the so-called war on terrorism, and at least 119 people were subjected to the CIA's rendition, detention, and interrogation RDI program, the HRW and Cost of War Project notes. No U.S. officials have been held accountable for that torture. The military prison has remained open, costing U.S. taxpayers $540 million per year. Under former Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump, and now President Joe Biden, who has signaled that he intends to close Guantanamo. Around the world, Guantanamo remains one of the most enduring symbols of injustice, abuse, and disregard for the rule of law that the U.S. unleashed in response to the 9/11 attacks. Report co-author Letta Taylor, an associate director in HRW's Crisis and Conflict Division, said in a statement. Taylor and co-author Elisa Epstein, a University of Chicago Law School student who was previously an advocacy officer at HRW, pressured Biden to finally shut down the prison and more. Biden should take bold steps to repair the damage from abusive U.S. interrogations and detentions, starting with the closure of the U.S. prison at Guantanamo, Taylor and Epstein wrote. They also urge him to release the 2014 torture report from the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, noting all but a heavily redacted summary remains classified. The authors point out that Biden, like Obama and Trump, has shown no appetite for releasing the torture report, much less criminally investigating the architects of the RDI program, and that the president also opposes allowing the International Criminal Court to include abuses by U.S. nationals in its investigation on grave human rights crimes in Afghanistan. As the paper details, the Taliban's return to power and the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021 will test the U.S. government's legal rationale for indefinite law of war detentions at Guantanamo, as well as the Biden administration's commitment to adopting a more rights-respecting approach to counterterrorism. Thus far, Biden administration actions raise sobering questions about its commitment to ending the so-called war on terror. Measures of concern include the Justice Department's willingness to sidestep critical legal questions on habeas rights for the men held at Guantanamo and to block certain testimony related to CIA torture, and Biden's apparent intent to continue using lethal force outside recognized war zones with drone strikes and special forces raids, euphemistically rebranded as over-the-horizon operations. The authors highlight that abroad, the U.S. has continued abusive practices against terrorism suspects, including transferring them to countries that torture and, in at least some cases, unlawfully detaining them at U.S.-run sites abroad or at sea. Although such U.S. detention-related counterterrorism violations have dramatically decreased, Washington has replaced capture with kill, conducting airstrikes, often with armed drones that have killed thousands of civilians, including outside recognized battlefields, the writers of the report note, adding, its counterterrorism campaign has spread to 85 countries with scant transparency or oversight. Taylor and Epstein recommend that Biden increase transparency and accountability for other crimes and violations perpetrated in the name of countering terrorism, including unlawful airstrikes and raids that kill and injure civilians both in and out of recognized war zones. The president should officially apologize and provide redress to victims.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.